Hello, everybody. This is Adam Serwer with the American Prospect. I'm here with Dan Foster of National Review. And what are we here to talk about today, Dan?
Hi, Adam. Well, I think, we're operating on a bit of a clock here, right, because the big story all over political journalism today is the first major GOP primary debate last night. And it will be the big story for approximately 15 more minutes. And then everyone will forget everything that happened there. So we should probably talk about it while we can. This is my wheelhouse, so I'll just tell you my general impressions. And I don't think that they're that different from the kind of conventional wisdom, which is that, as I said last night, tweeting around on it, watching the end of it, I thought the biggest surprise of the night, to me and to a lot of people, even to some of her supporters and her cheerleaders, was Michelle Bachmann's performance, which I thought was quite good. And the biggest disappointment was Herman Cain's. After not seeing him in the last debate, which I didn't see the last debate, which apparently he won, according to some of my friends on the right, I was expecting a, pragmatic, decision-oriented, but also folksy and charming guy that I had heard about and that I've, read about. And it looked like he was just a little bit out of his depth. And while I think he has good instincts, you can say this about a lot of these sort of government outsiders that people want to run. I think he has good instincts, but I just, liberal friends of mine tell me that conservative, how can you like conservative political hopeful or conservative politician X? They're so dumb or they're so intellectually uncurious. And I won't name any names, but you get that a lot. And what my standard retort to that is that conservatives want a government simple enough that candidate X can run it, right? Mm. I think that's true. I certainly believe that myself. But the fact is that I think a lot of us get the causation backwards. And whether we like it or not, the federal bureaucracy is a leviathan of unparalleled proportions. And the President of the United States has to be not just a super smart guy, but also a guy who's educated enough in the Byzantine and Baroque architecture of that bureaucracy to handle it. So as much as conservatives want a smaller, simpler government, one of the things I'm always urging my fellow conservatives about is recognize that you need a man who can manage that bureaucracy to get you there. You need a Gorbachev. Even if you want to dismantle the state, you need transitional figures. The danger there is that, people get captured by the bureaucracy and then they end up exploiting it, for their own ends. Yada, yada, yada. But all of this is a roundabout way of saying that while everything I know about Herman Cain suggests that he was a great business leader and is certainly a devout constitutionalist, he's also not a constitutional scholar, and he doesn't have a single drop of experience managing, as I said, that federal leviathan. And so when you see him in a debate like this, you really, really hope for some evidence that he's done some pretty intense homework. And I just didn't see any of that last night. I mean, what were your general impressions of winners and losers?
I actually thought Romney won that debate, and maybe that's because we're at the point where people just aren't coming after him much yet. But I thought, I thought it was. I mean, he sort of struck me as someone who seemed actually pretty comfortable, particularly given the sort of media memes that have risen up around his candidacy. I'm not exactly puzzled by the rise of Herman Cain, but I certainly don't think he has much longevity as a candidate. I mean, I just think that for Republicans, I think foreign policy is actually pretty important to Republicans, and perhaps maybe even more important than Democrats who are a lot more... Who recently have been a lot more focused on, sort of bread and butter issues, particularly because the bad economy is threatening to discredit the Democratic president. currently in office. But, I mean, you know, it's not, you know, someone like Kane, who's sort of, I suppose, very straightforwardly said that he's too ignorant about certain issues like Afghanistan to comment on them, and then he sort of didn't, he didn't really understand the controversy around Palestinian right of return. I mean, these are things that I think Republicans really, really want their presidential candidate to understand. And yeah. they're just things that Kane not just doesn't have any experience in, because, I mean, that's not really, it's something he just doesn't understand very well. And right. hasn't taken the time to understand. I mean, at the very least, you know, it's not like Barack Obama spent a whole lot of time in foreign affairs before he started running for president. But he demonstrated a grasp of the issues that I think was surprising even to, you know, even to his rivals. I mean, he held his own in a debate, you know, with John McCain, who's of course one of the most prominent Republican foreign policy leaders for the past 20 years or so. I mean, there's just no evidence that someone like Kane really has the chops in that area. And just saying Sharia law, American law for American courts, that's not going to do it. As much as some people might like that, I don't think it's enough to get people to really consider him as a serious candidate as he might want.
Yeah, and I think in general, for some of the reasons I just mentioned, that policy, the idea of mastery of the political process in Washington, there's a much higher value placed on that by Democrats and their presidential candidates than there is by Republicans. But I think both sides, and certainly the media, like to perpetuate this myth that, you know, the better presidents, the smart presidents, to name the last two Democrats who were both thought of as extraordinarily bright, you know, President Obama and President Clinton, but also President Carter was supposed to be the smartest guy in the room. I think there's this myth that those guys could sort of single-handedly fill in any role in the White House or in any role in the federal bureaucracy, that they understood, that they had such a master of the issues. I mean, Michelle Obama just said today that the president is better prepared. I'm not going to get the exact quotes right, but she just said today that the president's better prepared on the topics that he's briefed on than those people who are briefing him are. Now, I don't think that there's, if that's true, then he needs to get better briefers, right? Because I think that's a myth, and nobody would deny that President Obama is a brilliant guy. But the truth is that the president of the United States has to be a gifted generalist.
Yeah, exactly.
Who can BS about any topic for 10 minutes, you know, they're kind of like a press secretary. Mm-hmm. They really all have the same skill sets. Who can BS in front of the cameras on any topic for 10 minutes and then surround himself with people who know more about that topic and
right.
can make informed decisions based on that information. And Herman Cain doesn't even have that at this point, doesn't have that 10-minute mm-hmm. BS ability. For all of her other weaknesses, that is something that I think Sarah Palin has done a little bit of. She's markedly better at that 10 minutes of BS now than she was 2 years ago, and I think, you know, that's because she's gone and done some homework on it and read a book or two and surrounded herself with people who know more about it. But one little thread, and I don't know if there's anything to this, that you said that Kane just straight up admitted that he was too ignorant on certain topics, on Afghanistan, I think it was, to form an opinion. You know, that, although that's a little bit troubling, for the reasons I just mentioned, it's also kind of refreshing because it cuts through this idea that President Obama has all of the war planning contingencies mapped out by the Pentagon in Afghanistan committed to memory, and that he can make, you know, tactical decisions about the deployment of troops and about whether we should continue to push in Helmand Province just sort of on the back of a cocktail napkin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he obviously is surrounded by the Joint Chiefs and by a fleet of analysts and logistical thinkers that help make all these decisions. And I know all this sounds obvious, but our political discourse really doesn't bear it out. I mean, it really doesn't reflect the fact that these are massive group decisions. And what I thought of when you said that about Kane was that in 2004, Wes Clark, when he was thinking about running for president, he was on a plane. I forget where I read this anecdote, but he was on a plane and some reporter was embedded with him. asked him about some topic on domestic policy, and he said on the record right to his face, says, I don't know anything about that. I've never heard about it. Shouted to one of his domestic policy advisors sitting a few rows behind him on the plane, says, what do we think about that, right? And that was viewed as a knock and a mark of his inexperience. And I thought to myself, you know, although I wouldn't have voted for Wes Clark, I thought to myself, that's a general. You know, he's delegating. He understands that he's not the rifleman and the pilot and the artillery guy. He's the general. And I think that's what the president needs. But still, we want to see, you know, at the risk of my repeating myself, we want to see a candidate who's done enough homework that he has the broad contours of an issue mapped out, enough to have an initial opinion, and that then, you know, you trust him to surround himself with smart people. And
in part, that's
something...
why you look at who they've got around them. You know, it's not just a matter of what they say, but who is telling them, you know, what they should say.
Right.
You know, that's, I mean, Spencer Ackerman did a great piece for us, you know, in 2008 on Obama's foreign policy brain trust, and these people, you know, Susan Rice, Samantha Power, these are people who, you know, have gone on to play important roles in the administration, and I think that's, you know, the evaluation of those kinds of advisors is really important. And if you look at someone, Eli Lake did a similar piece more closely focused on the issue of terrorism, and he sort of predicted that Obama would retain much of the Bush approach on national security post 2006, and that's exactly what he did. And he predicted that, which was a fairly bold prediction at the time, given what Obama was saying. And he predicted that based on the people who Obama was taking advice from. And I think that's, you know, that's actually more important, a lot more important than what someone is necessarily saying about the issue, for the reasons you've described.
Yeah, I think that's true. I feel like I need to make a caveat here. Philosophically, I think that conservatism and conservatives are much more skeptical about what you might call the myth of the expert and the myth of expertise. I mean, I'm certainly not saying I'm much more skeptical, I think, than you are about the idea of a brain trust and how efficacious that sort of thing can be in solving really complex social problems and policy problems. But like I said, I do think just from a practical standpoint of navigating the organization and of understanding the kind of decisions that a president has to make, he's of course going to need to be very, very well advised. What I don't have in mind is, you know, a bunch of guys sitting around a room rubbing their temples and deciding how to end poverty as we know it.
But here's the other thing about brain trust. I think they're far more important in some ways in the foreign policy realm because, you know, the thing about Kane not knowing anything about foreign policy, the president has far more power and ability to act unilaterally in the realm of foreign policy than anything else. So I think, you know, no matter what legislative goals a president or a prospective candidate says they have, those are going to be tempered by their structural circumstances, depending on who's in charge in Congress, which party, and who's leading which party. And the same just isn't quite as true in foreign policy. The president just has much more leeway to act. And so I think it's, you know, in some ways it's actually a lot more important for the president to sort of not just be able to wing it, so to speak, but to have people around him who know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I want to talk more about foreign policy the president's foreign policy and as it relates to the debate, but before we do that, I wanted to just sort of trade opinions on how all the other candidates came off, and I think we can probably segue back to what I thought was the most interesting moment policy-wise, which was from the debate, which was foreign policy stuff. But in general, you know, my sort of takeaway was that, like I said, Bachman did very well, none of these candidates are Cicero. None of them are truly great orators. But she was really poised. She had, you know, she sprinkled in policy detail here and there, but she had really soundbite-friendly answers. She got from A to B efficiently without losing her way. She kind of stole the headline by announcing on stage, even though I don't think that's as big a deal as some other people do, because after all, she was appearing in a GOP primary presidential debate. And I think that for you know, when people talk about her TV appearances, she goes on both MSNBC and Fox, and you know, when I watch her on TV, I think she's just about as good as the average politician on TV. I mean, on cable news. So I never. Some people looked at that as a big negative for her, but I'm never really that impressed with. With a few exceptions, I'm never really that impressed with politicians on cable news. The kind of low point for me for Bachman in terms of her public persona was the Tea Party response to the State of the Union last year, which this was the kind of mini disaster where she was looking at the wrong camera the whole time, mm-hmm. and the speech itself just wasn't that annoying. Substantive, and it was very talking pointy. And very sort of glittering generalities, and I just think she did a much better job. And to me, the takeaway from this that I, you know, consequence for the race, is that I wonder if Nate Silver made this point today too. I wonder though if maybe Sarah Palin has missed her shot here. That Bachman having stepped up and done a really good job in a first major debate like this. And, you know, they're competing for a lot of the same constituents. I wonder if that's going to give her pause. And likewise, it's probably going to frustrate a lot of the other Republican contenders who were counting on Iowa. It's probably going to frustrate them because certainly they hope that neither Bachman nor Palin would get in. But they must now be hoping that if the one gets in, the other does, so that they sort
right,
of
so split the same
a trait, yeah, and split the vote. Whereas I think that looks less likely after last night, and that's got to be bumming them out. Did you have any impressions about that stuff?
Well, I think obviously Bachman's biggest opening is Iowa. She's just sort of got she has a big strategic advantage there in terms of the demographics of the GOP caucus electorate. I thought it was sort of. I mean, I think Newt, in particular, is fading fast.
Oh man!
I think
he looked like he couldn't be bothered.
Right. I mean, he. Aside from his campaign sort of imploding last week, this was sort of an opportunity to get back in the game and show everybody he was still serious. And I think he really sort of failed to even make himself known yesterday. You know, there wasn't a whole lot. When you're reading the debate recaps, there weren't a whole lot of reporters who thought Newt had much interesting to say or
right.
thought he had any particularly compelling moments.
Right, yeah, he was just kind of, I mean, he looked like he couldn't be bothered, and he's actually the guy, you know, getting back to what we were talking about before, he's the guy who probably has the best handle of policy minutiae on the stage, at least at the federal level. I mean, Romney's a quick study, Pawlenty's a quick study, and they have tons of executive experience. But this is a guy who herded the group of wild horses that is the U.S. House of Representatives for 4 or 5 years, and he's a big policy nerd, and he had an opportunity, I think, but also a fairly effective communicator when he wants to be and when he makes the effort. So he had the opportunity, I think, to kind of savvily outclass these guys on policy specifics and on presentation, and he just instead what he did was he in bizarre answer after bizarre answer he either didn't say anything at all of substance or he like zeroed in on one particular aspect of a problem that might be interesting in a cabinet meeting or principals meeting in the National Security Council but just is not interesting in a debate. I mean, when they were talking about Libya, there was a question about Libya. Gingrich's entire answer was on our, you know, intelligence capabilities on the ground and our ability to know what percentage of the anti-Qaddafi rebellion is al-Qaeda. And that's not the sort of. I mean, the question was about whether we should be in Libya, and he answered by talking about for a debate limited to 2-minute answers, he got into the weeds too much, and that just sort of characterized his whole response. I mean, I agree that what you said at the top with that Romney really did well for himself, and you're right. I think he looks a lot more comfortable in 2012 than he did in 2008. He looks less like a game show host, and I honestly think part of it is that it ain't his first rodeo anymore. Part of it's that he's smart enough to know that it was a negative for him and has actually worked on it. The kind of wooden Ken doll-ish ness of his, you know, self presentation. But part of it's simply the cosmetic fact that he's got a little more gray hair, he's a little older, and a little, I think, just softer in manner. And he certainly looks more comfortable. Last thing I'll say is that Pawlenty, who I think had the biggest blown opportunity here, while he didn't really do any damage to himself, he also didn't stand out. And for a guy whose entire campaign is staked on being the generic mainstream conservative Republican who is not Mitt Romney, he didn't take the opportunity last night to show that's him. And again, you know, Nate Silver made a good point about this today. He said that while the standard thinking on this might be that Pawlenty's playing a long game here and realizes that he's got plenty of time to zero in on Romney and attack Romney later, and shouldn't do so now, there's also this guy Rick Perry in Texas, and Rick Perry is leaning heavily towards getting in based on all the sources we've talked to here, and certainly a lot of folks think that his entry into the race is imminent. And Rick Perry could not only be the mainstream, you know, telegenic, generic conservative that's not Mitt Romney, but he could also, as Silver points out, really fit the Buckley rule, the so-called Buckley rule named after our founder, that conservatives should support the most conservative candidate that is electable. And I think Rick Perry is probably right there at the edge of that equation.
Right. Well, I've been arguing for a little while now that Romney's challenge is not to convince everyone that he's the most orthodox conservative in the race, but that he's the one with the best chance of beating Obama. And I think Perry is probably the biggest threat to that perception. I think it also has to do with, you know, his being governor of the biggest state in the country. He said some nutty things, but he's also he's very much trusted by the religious coalition in the Republican Party, and he has these bona fides as a governor, as someone who can, you know, actually manage a government. So I think if I were Romney, I would be very worried about him getting into the race for the reasons that you described. Because I mean, it's now Romney who's making the case that I'm the most conservative electable candidate. And I think Perry definitely hurts his ability to make that case if he gets in.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, although, you know, what you said is also true, that he won a major victory just by not having to spend all night fending off attacks on Romney care and on healthcare. Mm-hmm. So that's good for him. If the conversation's moving beyond that, and I don't think it ever really will, but if the conversation's expanding outside of that, as it were, then it can only be good for him. But I do want to get back to this foreign policy question, because I thought that was both the most interesting part of the debate and the most timely for our purposes here today, which is that, you know, the candidates were asked a couple questions, one about whether we should be in Libya, one about whether we should be operating over Yemen with drones and special forces strikes, and one was just about sort of Afghan policy in general. That was funny. I think Romney had a classic Kinsley gaffe in answering a question about policy in Afghanistan, which is that he said something to the effect of, "We need to stay there long enough to ensure an orderly transition to the Taliban military when we leave." And they cut to this Marine officer in the audience whose eyes just about popped out of his head when he said that. And then Romney quickly corrected himself. But I think he spoke more of the truth than he knows. For those of us who are not all that optimistic on the outcome in Afghanistan, but there's, you had a lot of people giving variants of this answer on those sorts of questions. We'll do whatever it takes to protect America from terrorists and extremists, and in the conflicts we're already engaged in, we need to, you know, shape our policy around the input of generals in the field, and as president, I'm going to take their advice first and foremost before I make any decisions about, say, Iraq or Afghanistan in this case.
I think that's a really weird thing that Democrats and Republicans actually both do that is sort of a really problematic trend in politics is this idea that this sort of rhetorical abdication of the commander-in-chief role where you're saying, I'm going to do whatever the generals tell me to do, and that really has it backwards. I mean, the president is the person who's uniquely suited to consider all the factors, including military advice from the generals, but you don't simply outsource that kind of decision-making. And I think Ron Paul was the person, Ron Paul's not my favorite person, but he gave the best answer to that, which is that, you know, the president makes these decisions, the generals don't make these decisions. And I remember back when, you know, when liberals were slamming Bush over the Iraq War, they were saying he refused to consider advice from the generals, but the issue is not, you know, the issue was that Bush ignored opinions that were true, that were contrary to what he wanted to hear. I mean, that's one thing. It's another thing to say that the job of the president is to channel whatever the generals tell him to do. That's something that really has to, that version of political argument, I think, is really problematic. And it's sort of, it's understandable in the sense that it's downright anti-American, but it's understand, like, what's really sort of happening here is there's this weird political dynamic where government is really, Americans don't trust government. They have really negative opinions of officials in the government, but they have really high opinions of the military. So the military is one of the few, like, really trusted institutions in government. And politicians, presidents, who are perhaps less trusted, even sometimes by their own supporters, do this thing where they borrow the legitimacy of the military by saying, I'm going to listen to what the generals say and then I'm going to do that. But that's not, first of all, no president, Republican or Democrat, wants to hear that once they're president and they have to make a decision that maybe kind of sort of isn't exactly what the generals want, because they don't want to come under fire for not refusing to respect this like bizarro chain of command that's been created by our political discourse. Someone like Romney, if he's going to make a decision that maybe he thinks is best, that, you know, isn't necessarily exactly what the generals want, he's not going to be very happy to hear everybody saying, well, you said you'd listen to the generals. But that's exactly what you don't say. That you don't, I mean, of course you listen to the generals, but you don't outsource that kind of decision making. It's just, I think it's really bad. And it's something that, has really sort of become common, but it's something that really shouldn't be a part of. I mean, it's disturbing to see how banal it's become.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're almost becoming a really, really soft, version of a kind of Turkey-like, where in Turkey, you know, you have the generals kind of oddly, balancing the secular and religious forces in the country, and sort of every once in a while, the expectation is they're going to have to come in and overthrow a duly elected executive, and everyone's sort of okay with that.
We don't want that.
I mean, we're not anywhere near there. But you're right when you said bizarre chain of command, that they're the most trusted organ of the federal government is the military, and we've definitely, I think it's mostly salutary, but we've definitely, both sides of the political aisle have internalized this. This idea that the troops themselves are beyond reproach, and I think a lot of the flag pin wearing, flag waving, support the troops stuff ends up being empty and ends up doing a disservice to our armed forces. I do think that's mostly salutary. That's a good thing that both sides of the aisle have internalized this idea that don't blame the troops, but that's different than the the thing that we're talking about. And I certainly agree that president needs to be the commander in chief. But this brings us to what I think is the real problem in Afghanistan. In sound by form is that there's no mission. Or if there is a mission, it hasn't, it's not one that the American people are buying or that can be quantified or operationalized sufficiently, so that we will have any hope of knowing when it's been accomplished. And I think that's what, Republicans should be saying is not that, listen to the generals, but that I trust the generals to be able to execute any set of clear objectives that I give them. So you have to give them the political goals and the sort of strategic goals on the ground that you want to accomplish, and then, it's their job to advise the president on how best to do that at the level of tactics and logistics and war fighting, obviously. And so that's where the advice I'll tell us in the generals, that's where that should enter into the conversation. But guess what? You have to provide the political framework and get into the weeds here for a second. I mean, what's interesting to me about the role of Petraeus, particularly this one man, I mean, McChrystal to a certain extent too, and some of the other theater commanders to varying degrees, but definitely Petraeus, is that he has taken on this almost prime ministerial role in American foreign policy, at least in the countries in the Middle East which we currently have war fighters. He's not just a military tactician, but the revolution in counterinsurgency doctrine and in hearts and minds warfare has given him a sort of, I think, unprecedented political dimension and a political mission that we haven't really seen with American generals abroad. Even in say Marshall Plan Europe, I think that, and especially Petraeus embodies this because here's a guy with a PhD from Princeton, who's not just a brilliant tactician, but if I'm not mistaken, a trained political scientist. I think his role has been unique among American generals in that aspect. And I do think people. He was the only guy. This was probably President Obama's smartest decision. When the McChrystal thing happened, and everyone was wondering about whether or not it would destabilize our war effort in Afghanistan, in a master stroke, President Obama appointed Petraeus, technically demoting him, to take over, and everyone was sort of like left and right. So, well, absolutely. That was exactly what you should have done. So he has this unique role, and I think it probably... has something to do with those domestic dynamics that you were talking about as being problematic, but it's also just due, I think, to the nature of Petraeus himself.
There's a lot of reasons why it was sort of politically savvy for him to replace McChrystal with Petraeus. But I also think Tom Ricks had a good piece in the New York Times right after this, which is it cemented the perception that there's a single competent general in the U.S. Armed Forces, which I think is not is not true. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be sort of interesting to see how the Republicans run on foreign policy, not just because of the bin Laden thing, but I think it's sort of, they're going to have to incorporate a lot of the sort of critiques of Obama for the left about leaving Afghanistan, while at the same time insisting on finishing the job, so to speak. I mean, I definitely don't think. I think there's a lot more, and I think we probably will see to a certain extent a lot of attacks on Obama on Libya from the left. But I don't think the same is true of Afghanistan. And I think the administration has has itself to blame for a lot of the objections to Libya. I mean, chief among them, the lack of a sort of strategic rationale for how this was all going to end, but also the refusal to go not refusal, but the sort of failure to go to Congress for an explicit authorization, I think is a huge political mistake. And I think the administration may have been worried about another about sort of having to negotiate for that and having to give something else up that they didn't want to give up. But it just makes them look like, you know, from my perspective, it gave the right one of its first real constitutional objections to the way that Obama has conducted himself while in office. You know, to say, you know, I'm going to take the American people to war in Libya, but, you know, as long as there's not a substantial risk to U.S. personnel and there aren't thousands of people on the ground, that it's not a real war, Congress has to give approval. I think that's really problematic. And I think that you're probably going to see, particularly since the intervention in Libya isn't particularly popular, I think there is going to be a sort of interesting flashback to, like, Somalia in the mid-90s, where you see a lot of Republicans attacking a Democratic president from the left for not having a clear mission, saying we need to get out, saying we don't know what we're doing. But less so on Afghanistan.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the trend that we've set up over the last couple of decades is that Republican presidents tend to fight bigger wars, but they tend to, even if they don't get formal declarations, they tend to, use Congress, or at least, bring Congress into the conversation, and also the UN in the case of the invasion of Iraq, and NATO in the case of the mission in Afghanistan. So for all this talk about unilateralism under President Bush, he was pretty good at bringing, bring Congress on board, yes, and trying to bolster his legitimacy even with international bodies. Whereas Democrats, Clinton and Obama both, have fought much smaller wars, usually with air power alone, and or very, very limited ground engagement, and have bypassed Congress a lot more frequently. I think that's an interesting dynamic, and I don't think it's a I don't think it's a good one. And why don't you tell? See, I have to admit, I shouldn't admit this because this is what we do for a living. But I like the American public, am I think war weary, and I think that's the big dynamic behind the change in perception about Afghanistan, and that's the big dynamic behind the unpopularity of Libya. Because the initial strike was fairly popular when we thought it was going to be shock and awe campaign. Yeah, the in and out. And then when we realized sort of that there was no even predetermined end state and that we sort of were trying to kill Gaddafi but not really. And then once we abdicated tactical command of the operation, although we can talk about whether or not we're still, de facto leading the effort, I think that just confused a lot of Americans and just sort of made them not want to bother with it. So, I mean, what is going on in Libya? Where do we go?
It looks to me like we're basically in a stalemate at the moment. I mean, the rebels don't have enough strength to defeat Gaddafi. Gaddafi doesn't have enough strength to defeat the rebels. And there, I think if this had ended quickly, it wouldn't have been a big deal. You wouldn't have seen people in Congress protesting. But I think you're right. I mean, I think people are a little concerned about the U.S. being overextended, and I think they're just sort of confused as to why we're there in the first place. I think that the president's speeches while giving, I thought his speeches offered some pretty strong rationales, but the fact is speeches fade, memories fade, and right now I think people just aren't really sure what, I don't think there's a very clear explanation to that Americans can point to and say, this is why we're in Libya right now, this is why we're doing what we're doing, the same way I think you maybe could back in the mid-90s even. When Clinton was intervening in the Balkans, I think that because so much had happened in the Balkans, because the suffering was really clear, the ethnic cleansing, that was just that was just so vivid. And in the case of Libya, because the administration, according to the administration, they prevented us Srebrenica on steroids, there isn't the same, we have instead this idea that a genocide that would have happened was stopped, instead of sort of rather vivid evidence of one that was already occurring.
And I'll suspect you'll be sympathetic to this point. I don't doubt that there's also the distinction that the Balkans are in Europe and Libya ain't. You know, that certainly matters when you're trying to sell these sort of interventions to the American people. But the lesson I take from Libya is that we did it because we thought we could. We thought it would be fairly easy. And you know, I think there was, not to lessen the kind of geopolitical thinking that went into the decision, I think there's a decent realist argument for, punishing a guy who is not just slaughtering his own people, but has been a major, major pain in the rear end for America for decades. So, you know, there is that geopolitical case. I don't think it's determinative. But if you look at what we did in Libya versus what we did in Egypt versus what we're not doing at all in Syria, you kind of have to, it's kind of tough to look for a common thread. I mean, I guess if I had to make the case for the status quo, for the decisions that the administration has made, I'd say you use force in Libya because it's a tin pot regime that you could quickly destroy. And then the mistake there is not using enough force to finish the job. To this day, the Powell Doctrine continues to be ignored, right? I mean, overwhelming force, right? And in Egypt, of course, the determining factor is, I think, their peace treaty with Israel, and was the main reason. Because we haven't, I don't think it would have been enough just to say, well, Mubarak was in our pocket for years and years and years. I mean, the realist in me suggests that sort of wouldn't matter once the tides had turned, but I think the real determining factor was the border and the treaty with our key ally in the region, and the worry about it destabilizing that region. But you know, President Obama being one of the, and I do think President Obama is a Israel hawk, but certainly by standards of the United States government, one of the most dovish Israel hawks. It made sense that they kind of handled Egypt with kid gloves. Syria, I can't really figure out, because on the one hand, they are, if the worry there is, maybe you can tell me why we just haven't even lifted a finger or really done all that much shouting even about Syria. The Assads are, a Hussein-style Ba'athist dictatorial regime that represented, their clan is a tiny, tiny minority in the country. They're secular, which I guess is good. I mean, that's the reason why we backed Saddam Hussein over the Shah in the war against Iran. They're secular, but then again, Syria is a client state of Hezbollah. It's a client state of Iran. And it seems like a perfect opportunity for us to inflict some pain on that establishment, or at least try and shape the course of the outcome there. I mean, am I being naive? I mean, what's the deal with Syria? Why aren't we doing more there?
Well, I think that the difference between Libya and Syria is actually, so one of the reasons why we're not, quote-unquote, going into Libya with enough force to finish the job, I think that the opportunity that the Obama administration sensed in Libya was this opportunity to intervene militarily on behalf of one of the indigenous uprisings of the Arab Spring, right? So if the narrative
is
that...
Was it a token?
I'm sorry?
Was it a token then?
We'll do it here. We'll do it here, and I think in part because there was... I think Libya... Well, I think they said, we'll do it here, but the reason you can't put ground troops down is because while the rebels asked for air assistance, they certainly didn't ask for ground troops. In fact, they were explicitly opposed to it. So the line between, you know, I think imperialist action as seen by the rebels and like welcome international assistance is kind of fine, and I think that's why and the political peril of putting American troops on the ground in yet another Muslim country, I think, made it virtually impossible. I think in the case of Syria, things are, I mean, in general, I think that the U.S. has a very limited set of options and just really doesn't have as much control over outcomes in these places as I think pundits sometimes seem to think we do. There's certain things the administration can do. I think political sanctions are preferred option because economic ones just tend to hurt the people who have the least access to power. But I think, in general, I mean, it's like the administration can talk a whole lot, but it doesn't matter who's in charge. I mean, if there were a Republican president in charge, the fact is the American military is engaged in at least three ongoing military conflicts. Well, I mean, Iraq less so at this point, but we don't have the resources sometimes to invade yet another country, and I think in general we should be extremely skeptical about the ability of military force to engineer the kind of outcome we want in some place like Syria. I mean, there's sort of a delicate balance. The hope is, of course, that the reformers will prevail, but there's just not much the U.S. can do to make things any better for them, as much as we might like to.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I think there's a political appetite for saying stand up to this tyrant and tell him what the business is, but there have been a lot of condemnations, there's been a lot of rhetoric from the administration, and it's just not, you know, these people are ruthless, and they're going to do what they can to stay in power, and the idea that, you know, they're going to slaughter a whole bunch of their own people, but, you know, when American president stands up and wags their finger, they're going to suddenly, you know, get the picture. I mean, that's just not going to happen. These guys don't care. They're going to do what they can to stay in power. And what really matters, I think, and you're starting to see a little bit of this in Syria, and you certainly saw it in Tunisia, is when the internal security forces decide that they're not going to listen to the regime, that the regime has gone too far. That's the tipping point. And in Egypt, we had a little more influence. We had a little more leverage because the connections between the Egyptian military and the U.S. are much closer than in Syria. But there just isn't. I just don't see where there's a whole lot the administration can do, unfortunately, to help these people.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, and also, I mean, in general, maybe you can tell, but I'm being tentative because about this sort of stuff, because in general, I'm very reluctant to criticize administrations on means in affecting foreign policy goals, especially when it comes to the use of either espionage or force, but even to a limited extent, I'm hesitant to criticize them on ends, not just means, because, you know, the one example I use is that I read five or six years ago in I think it was in Foreign Affairs, this very cogent, well-reasoned argument from a Middle Eastern scholar, security studies scholar, something like that, about how we were paying way too much attention to Al-Qaeda and not enough attention to Hezbollah, and that Hezbollah was, not only had two state sponsors in the form of, Syria and Iran, and was not only a de facto state in Lebanon, but was upping its capabilities to strike at American interests and was becoming more interested in doing so. And I left this article thinking to myself, my God, the president doesn't know what he's doing. We're doomed. Hezbollah's going to get us. And what a terrible foreign policy blunder that we're not going after these guys. Come to find out a few months later that we had basically infiltrated all of Hezbollah's communications. We were reading all of their messages. We had, cracked their codes. We had, we could track all their movements at the scale of military formations and also operating, you know, cells, and that we just had a really, really good look at the inside Hezbollah. Unfortunately, I found this out because one of the things that I might be speaking mistakenly, but I think it was Chalabi. One of the things that he told the Iranians about U.S. operations was that you know, we had Hezbollah's communications network cracked. So the point being, though, that I always think that's a really good anecdote about how just sort of little we know about what is maybe even being done at the clandestine level. And I know there was a great New York Times story over the weekend about setting up like the Internet 2 or independent internets in a lot of these Middle Eastern countries and more broadly just countries where human rights and censorship is a big issue, that the State Department is making a big push to set up freestanding access to the Internet that's outside the communications infrastructure of whatever state we're talking about. And, you know, they've got these cool things like Internet in a suitcase that just bypasses the infrastructure, you know, the communications infrastructure, and therefore the censorship of these countries. You know, we're apparently burying encrypted cell phones in the hills on the border between North Korea and China for dissidents to dig up, make calls, and redig. I mean, so we are doing some cool stuff, and maybe we're doing some cool stuff like that in Syria. But I do want to, before we end, talk about an unmitigated military victory, which was the young Wolf Rob Stark moving not one but two armies through the neck and confronting the Lannister host and dealing them a decisive defeat. I wonder what your thoughts on this are. Maybe you can explain to people what we're talking about.
So I actually had a conversation with Spencer Ackerman the other day about how so we're talking about the HBO series Game of Thrones, and Spencer Ackerman made one of the awesomest military nerd arguments to me, which is that Prince Rhaegar, in his battle at the Trident, made a strategic mistake by not falling back to King's Landing and instead deciding to meet Robert in the field. I thought that was really funny. He told me he had looked at the map and decided that Rhaegar had a lot more space to retreat before ultimately having to confront Robert's army. I just thought that was pretty funny. So the HBO series Game of Thrones is about to come to an end, and I think this week was sort of, it was funny, it was billed to Entertainment Weekly as a shocker, but it's something that, you know, it has been known for 10 years ever since the first book in the series came out, which is that the traditional male protagonist of Game of Thrones, Ned Stark, is beheaded by the new king Joffrey, who's a sociopathic 13-year-old, against the wishes of his mother, who understands that this is a strategic disaster because he's basically eliminated the last hope of averting civil war. But I've been pretty impressed by the series, and my biggest worry actually now, and I think it's probably unfounded, is that people will be so angry about Sean Bean being kicked off the show, but you know, because his character is dead, that they're going to sort of give up entirely. Right. I mean, he's on the billboards, but you know, he is the Tony Soprano of the show. And like, what would the Sopranos be like if Tony got killed in the first season? Well, it actually might have been a very interesting, albeit very different show. But the sort of, you know, the interesting thing about his death is, of course, that he indicates to the audience that there is no plot armor for any of these characters. There's no one who is so important to the story that they're necessarily going to survive to the end. And I think that's one of the things to like about it. I mean, at its core, the show is really sort of, it's less about grand battles between armies that represent good and evil, and much more about politics. And politics is something Ned was very bad at, in part because he was, you know, the traditional fantasy protagonist who cares so much about honor and always does the right thing and is very physically brave, but is sort of dense when it comes to the more subtle arts of manipulation.
Yeah, I mean, I have really enjoyed the series. I actually haven't seen the last episode, because as you said, those of us who've known exactly how the season was going to end since we read the books, for me it became it wasn't a shocker, obviously, but it was a sense of dread, you know, and I didn't get the opportunity to this. I have it, you know, I have the episode. I didn't get the opportunity to watch it yet, but I keep putting it off. As silly as that sounds, because when you read that first book, and I hadn't so much as read Lord of the Rings. You know, I read The Hobbit when I was a kid, but I hadn't so much as read Lord of the Rings when I picked up this series of books. I was not a fantasy guy. It was on repeated urgings from my friends to read it that it wasn't your typical fantasy novel. And nevertheless, when I got to the scene. Right towards the end of the book, and the way they kill him too. I mean, it's not. He doesn't die off screen. He doesn't die nobly, you know. Anyway, I mean, it's a really bum scene, bummer of a scene. And when it happened, I remember, you know, I emailed or text messaged the kid who told me that I should read the books and said, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you killed Ned Stark. You know, I assigned personal responsibility because I had gotten so invested. In the characters, you know, but you're right that it serves as a warning, and believe me, people, if you're thinking about not watching the next season, it gets worse. You know?
Yeah, it does get worse.
This you'll look back at this and think that it was nice, you know, that it was a mercy or something. I'm encouraged, you know, and I shared that worry with you that maybe this will just turn people off so much. That, I mean, it's much, much more of a shocker, I think, than when they kill Wallace, the kid at the end of the first season of of The Wire. And Wallace is another guy. He's just he's a good kid. You know, he's raising a bunch of brothers, and you know, I think you know, just raising a bunch of kids who just didn't have any, and he gets sort of just chewed up in the West Baltimore drug game, and he's a teenager, and he just gets killed in a pretty noble way. And that I remember at the end of the first season really bummed me out about The Wire, but I certainly didn't stop watching the show. And I'm heartened with Game of Thrones because, to be honest with you, the first three or four episodes I thought were just so slow and so dense with backstory, and even the ridiculous amount of exposition that they packed into those first few episodes was not enough. I found myself having to explain things to the people I was watching the show with. And then I was just worried that it was completely doomed, that there was just too much to follow and to catch up on, and that it wasn't going to be a successful show. But by now, I'm sort of, you know, you look around, and people who haven't read the books are really enjoying the show, and not just sort of traditional nerds that you'd expect to, but it's being enjoyed by the same kind of broad audience, I think, that shows like The Sopranos and The Wire were enjoyed by, and it's because of what you said, the fact that the books and the show are really about politics, and that war, which plays a very prominent role in the series, far from being a kind of decisive battle between good and evil, it's just sort of a thing that befalls people, and some people suffer more than others, but everyone suffers, and you know, it's often arbitrary and brutish, and you know, and in that context, it makes the sort of political maneuvering even more interesting, because it takes, you know, center stage as the locus of action, and the thing that's going to determine at the end of the day, you know, how this thing all plays out.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that the show does that I think the book does as well is that there's very little war that takes place on screen. And I think that's, you know, partially due to budget constraints, but I also think it's important because it avoids the trap of really, I think, glorifying that stuff. There's been a lot of sort of joking about the technique that the series has used of giving lots of exposition while naked women are on screen. I believe the term is exposition. As a way to try and make the delivery of that information less boring. But I think it's pretty interesting that there have been no flashbacks. It would have been so tempting to sort of depict some of these awesome battle scenes that get discussed, you know, in a flashback. Instead, you know, even the present ones aren't really shown. I mean, like, in they do something different in the book, which is in the book, you actually, the battle scene is actually described, that the feint where Robb Stark sends 2,000 soldiers to fight Tywin Lannister is actually described, because you see the battle from Tyrion's perspective, but in the show they did something really weird, which is that Tyrion gets knocked out his tribesmen are running to battle. So he wakes up after the battle's over and there are corpses all over the place, but you never see this sort of, you're never given the sort of escapist, awesome epic battle scene that I think you would expect from a fantasy show. And that's in part because I suspect that might have something to do with money, but I think it's also because the producers have really grasped the idea that this is not about awesome action heroes, but about, you know, it's about war and politics and almost everything else that is lived as a result of war, rather than being about glory itself.
Yeah, and I think just sort of aesthetically and in terms of making sure that the show has kind of an integrity, I think that they're following the lead of the best epic, you know, the best epic movies and the best superhero movies of the last 10 years, where it wasn't plot serving these major set pieces, which
right.
is this syndrome that movies got into after, you know, plot and character serving these major set pieces, that after the success of Lord of the Rings, which I think was sort of transitional, I think as those movies went along, the set pieces became more, I mean, the peak was sort of Helm's Deep, I think, and the second one, Helm's Deep, was an awesome sequence, and it
right.
served a really a cool and interesting plot. By the third one, I think even they were doing it, where all this exposition and plot sort of had the feeling of just getting you from one epic battle
yeah.
to the next. And in the 10 years since then, or 7 years since then, we've just seen so many other pieces of crap, either set in the Middle Ages or the future,
mm-hmm.
or some old, you know, where it's just and bad superhero movies too, where it's just
right.
one big battle after another. Now, don't get me wrong; there's plenty of big battles left in the in the books, and
yeah,
there are going to be
and
another, you know, spoiler without getting specifics, there will be some opportunities for incredible visuals. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure we're probably thinking of some of the same ones, but and the wall looks really impressive. I mean, it's a visually very pretty show, but yeah, it's not
yeah.
just 20 minute battle sequences. Yeah, so I'm looking. I'll watch this episode and I'll watch the season finale on time, and then we'll sit around and wait for a year and a half while they produce another season.
yeah.
And then you know, what is it? July 14th, right? The fifth book. July
yeah, the next book comes out July 14th. I'm excited. I'm not like other. I only recently read the books, so I'm not like some others who have been waiting a few years.
Yeah,
for the next book in the series. I who have been agonizing about this since 1996, waiting for the series to finish. But I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, definitely. I'm so glad we get to nerd out a little here at the end and talk more Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Well,
it's always
as
usual. It's great to talk to you.
Absolutely, and it's been a pleasure.
Right.
Have a good afternoon.
All right, take care.
Bye.